This is Remarkable. Welcome to Remarkable, a marketing podcast for podcasters who aren't marketers. I'm your host and teacher, Dave Mooring, and I want to know what it takes to stand out, get noticed, and build a committed audience of listeners and fans. I'm on a quest to find out what makes a podcast remarkable, and I invite you to join me each week as I interview other podcasters, experts, and marketers. The Remarkable Podcast is part of the Super Simple Podcast Network. If you'd like additional marketing resources, early access to my free podcast marketing course, and to be notified when I release future episodes, head on over to theremarkablepodcast.com. This is episode number 13. In this week's episode, I'm excited to share a lengthy discussion I had with a professional musician, film director, published author and talent director. He's best known for his work in sound and audio, and his list of clients includes Activision, Ubisoft, Sony, Electronic Arts, Microsoft, Fox, and Disney. He has recorded and produced over 600 commercial releases, including each of the following video game series: Call of Duty, Saints Row, Ghost Recon, Spider-Man, Tony Hawk Pro Skater, Persona, Rainbow Six, and Titanfall. During our conversation, we talk about his background and how he got into this line of work, and we get to hear his perspective on what it takes to make a name for yourself as an artist and a creative. He talks in depth about how to put together a great team for your creative project, the three elements of a strong team, and the key components needed when producing a drama or story-based show. We also cover how to go about finding great voice talent, how to build an audience early, and how to break through the noise and get noticed. He's the founder and president of PCB Productions, founding member of the band Contagion, author of three highly successful graphic novels, Ascend, Infex, and Dead Speed, and the director of the recent feature film, The Phoenix Incident. I'm excited to welcome Keith Arum. Keith, welcome to the Remarkable Podcast.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate your time, and I'm really excited about this. Just to give our listeners a little bit of a background, I got connected to you through a mutual friend of ours, Jay Posey, who is the author extraordinaire and also works over at Red Storm, the Ubisoft company. And I think you've crossed paths doing some game stuff. So
many a project with Jay.
So I'm really excited about talking to you. You said you're full of stories, so I'm hoping to hear some of those good stories. But since some of my audience might not be familiar with who you are, tell us a little bit about Keith Arum. So what's your current activities? What do you do on a daily basis?
Yeah, wow. That's a loaded question. I'm one of those guys that's kind of all over the place. My wife sort of refers to me as a shark because if I stop swimming, I'll die. I have to keep myself busy just because I have a really interesting background in a very extensive creative background and a very extensive technical background. And so I flip between creating technologies and then using those technologies in the projects that I work on. So I've been in the music industry, I've been in the television industry, I've been in the game industry for the past 20 years. I'm now moving into motion pictures and television as a creator and a writer and director. So it's been a great ride because I get to play and create on a daily basis, and I get to work with great clients, and I get to work with fantastic actors and celebrities and other writers and a lot of producers and creators. And it's just it's a fun sort of world right now because technology and creative are really merging in a unique way, and with distribution changing with not just the internet but the platforms that are using the internet, it's opening up an amazing time for independent creators. And that's sort of where my career is really focusing on right now, is working on these high-end projects that I've been doing and then using those resources and experience to create my own. And it's been a great ride.
Did I see somewhere, or did I read, did you get into this by way of music? Were you a musician first, or have you always been into audio?
I started as a musician. I started as a kid touring professionally when I was about 14 years old out in Arizona.
Wow. And what instrument?
It was all keyboards. It was my parents. It was funny. I had an old Apple computer. It wasn't old at the time. It was one of the newest things. And I had bought a synthesizer, an old Juno 106, which was one of the early MIDI synthesizers where you could actually hook up your computer to a synthesizer. And I started up a band when I was 14, and it was very successful for us. And we were on all the local radio stations. We played 2 to 3 concerts a week. And at 14 years old, I was making about $100 a night, which is kind of fun. But at 14 years old, my parents are driving me around and I'm doing these concerts all over Arizona. And we ended up being on the local cable access shows and television, all the newspapers. And as a kid, it was just a great experience because I'm going to school and making money and take all the money and put it back into equipment. So by the time I was a senior, I figured I'm going to go out to California and get a record deal. And of course, my folks are like, oh, there's drugs and it's, you know, it's a horrible industry and you need something to fall back on. And so I ended up coming out to California to get my engineering degree at Cal State. And they had amazing recording facilities at the studios there, these multi-million dollar recording studios. And I had amassed a lot of equipment from touring around with my band for years as a teenager. And so at 17, I was able to walk into these studios, and at night, after I was done with all my classes, I'd bring all my synthesizers in and start recording demos. And about 6 months into my freshman year, I had a big record deal with IRS Records, and which, of course, freaked out my parents because they thought it was just a passing phase and I'd, you know, turn into some other type of business person, but not a musician of anything. So my parents threatened to sort of any kind of support or help or anything else like that if I dropped out of school, which scared the bejesus out of me. And so I ended up turning down this big record deal at 17 years old, 18 years old with IRS. And all the other record companies thought I was playing hard to get. So by the time I was a senior, I had 30, 40 record deals on the table. And it was this amazing time because I had no idea. I had no perspective. I just, you know, I was writing music and we were playing these big concerts all over Los Angeles and we were selling out everywhere. And I'd started this band called Biohazard and we were doing great. And so by the time I was a senior, we had, it came down to 3 really big deals. We had a deal with Sony, a deal with Capitol, and a deal with Interscope Records. And those are like the top 3 choices of all the labels that we were talking about. And Capitol had this really cool marketing sort of idea to promote our record. And we were going to do this big takeover of the Capitol Records building and take the president hostage. And it was going to be this really, you know, it was way before 9/11, but it was this kind of interesting marketing approach for a band, especially for an independent band on a major label like Capitol. And so we took this deal and it was awesome until we realized that, you know, the music industry was not what it's cracked up to be. It was very interesting waters, especially when we took the deal, because the music industry was just about to get into the internet and we were using MP3s and other things to be able to distribute tracks to our fans. But the record industry really didn't understand what was happening. And we met with the president of EMI, which was our publisher, and we were talking to them about the problems with MP3s and the idea that this piracy was going to, you know, really undermine the record industry. They're like, this internet thing, that's not really going to catch on. No one's really going to pick this thing up. And we just kind of knew that was the beginning of the end. So I kind of used my experience and time working with a major record label like Capitol to really launch my music career. And you learn a lot when you're a musician, because you're learning about marketing, you're learning about distribution, you're learning about production. The creative side is great, but you create the album once and then you spend a year promoting it and touring and all the other appearances that you're doing. It teaches you a lot about how the industry works. And as you know, 20 years old, 21 years old, you know, being thrown into that is a bit of a challenge. So it was good education coming right out of school and making my own way. But
what was the name of your band?
So we started off as a band called Biohazard, and about a month before we released our album, we were about to go on tour. We found out that there was a local band in New York also called Biohazard, And even though we had already released albums and other things and had thousands of fans around the country, these guys filed a trademark in New York for the same name of the band.
Oh.
And Capitol came to us just before our album's done, and we already had the artwork, we'd already toured, we'd already done this all this work for promoting the band for 3 years, and probably more than that. And they made us change our name about a month before our album came out. And so we ended up becoming a band called Contagion. And what was amazing about that was we're immediately on tour. We got this big album coming out on Capitol Records, and we start touring, and all these people come out to these concerts, and they start accusing us of stealing all these Biohazard songs because they didn't realize that we had changed our name. And we're like, guys, it's us. We had to change our name. And I mean, even to this day, there's confusion between the two bands, and it's been, 20 years.
Wow. So, that's crazy.
Yeah. So it was a really interesting lesson in branding yourself and understanding, how to position yourself in the industry. Cause there's a lot of people out there that have similar ideas, and sometimes the person who has the bigger guns wins. And sometimes other people just don't want to go into that fight. And in this case, Capitol didn't want to fight the trademark, even though we probably could have won at the time. But it was a really interesting lesson in having to deal with that.
Yeah. I'm probably going to circle back around to the marketing question a little bit, maybe find out what you took away from that, but just to fast forward just a little bit more. So correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you've made kind of the biggest name for yourself in the past, I don't know, 10 or 20 years in the video game world. Is that right to date? Tell us a little bit about what's your involvement there and what's your company and what's your role in the video game world?
So my company now is PCB Productions, and that's been around for the past, since about 99, 2000.
Okay.
Before that, I had been the director of audio for Virgin Interactive and for Electronic Arts Pacific. And the funny thing was when I was in the music industry, everyone was saying, oh, you got to get into video games. And video games were just in their infancy when our album was coming out. But we were on these North American tours on our tour buses playing from city to city. And the whole time we're playing video games at the back of our tour bus. So when I got back, a friend of mine who is one of the senior vice presidents over at Sony said, hey, you really need to get into production. Because I had an engineering degree in audio engineering and had a recording background on Capitol Records. And I was starting to score motion pictures. And he got me involved in some of the very first Sega Genesis games that they were involved in producing, but then into the first PlayStation games. And so the first game I did, I think the first one I did was Battletech. And I think I wrote the score like in a week. It was like, it was just such a different format that was so easy to learn. And I just loved it. And I just stayed up and did the score and started winning all these awards and got brought in. I ended up doing a game called Earthworm Jim. And then all of a sudden I was just getting project after project, and I got hired at Virgin Interactive. And that just started my career in the audio side of things. And I was initially just as a composer. I had a background in music. I was composing, but I had an engineering degree. So I was doing sound effects, and I started doing movies, and I started doing cinematics. And because I did a lot of vocals for the bands that I was producing and recording on, it was an easy transition to start working with actors. And we were working on this huge game at the time back at Virgin, this game called Toonstruck. And our first celebrity that they were, and back then, celebrities in games was a very new thing.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They hired Tim Curry to come in to be the main villain on this game. And I was going to be engineering this thing, and I built all the studios at Virgin. And the producer walks into the studio. Tim Curry's about to show up. And the producer shows up, and the writer comes in. And I look around, and I said, well, who's directing the talent today? Who's directing, Tim Curry? And they looked around the room, and they're like, you're the audio guy. And so I was like, my very first trial by fire was working with Tim Curry. But it was such a great experience, and being able to work with, an actor of his caliber. I mean, you're not really directing him, much less as just enjoying his performance. But it was a really interesting time because you're starting to see how this blending of motion pictures and television and animation and video games was all coming together. So my career in games started in music, but then quickly began into audio and then writing and then directing and producing. And so after Virgin was bought out by EA, and I had already been at the company for 5 or 6 years, by 99, I decided to go on to business for myself, and I started PCB Productions. And since then, it's been almost 600 games now. And I've been in the industry, yeah, since I think starting in 93, 94, and PCB's been around since 99, 2000. And so we have 5 recording stages here in Los Angeles. And we specialize in doing motion capture and facial capture and ADR and voiceover and sound design and music and mixing. And it's been great. Worked on the last 11 Call of Duty games, the Ghost Recon franchise, and Spider-Man and Transformers and Tony Hawk. It's been a good ride.
That's awesome. What was the hardest part about going out into business on your own and getting started?
You know, it was actually probably one of the easiest decisions I've ever made. So many people, I think, are terrified into leaving the 9 to 5 and going into business on their own. And the only difference between, you know, working for a company and working for yourself is just a lot of just the maintenance of, well, you got to get insurance and you got to deal with, you know, having all of your own accounting and some of the stuff that people just dread having to do. But working on yourself by yourself and or for yourself is, I don't know, for me, it was just, I can't actually imagine really being in-house at a company now after that, just because it's so liberating. And sometimes when you're in-house at a company, there isn't a demand for you to be more efficient, because sometimes, you know, to keep your job, you're just sort of doing the 9 to 5 grind. And as part of a machine, everyone's kind of doing their own thing, but there's no reason to really be completely prepared for something because you're already on salary. There isn't any reason to really push that. But when you're an independent contractor, every hour, every minute counts, because that's a minute that you're earning a dollar or you're doing something. And it's not necessarily because of the money, but it just demands you be more efficient when you have your own company. And so what I realized was, when I was in-house working for companies, people would come really unprepared. They wouldn't have their scripts ready. They didn't know what they wanted, and they'd try to come to the studio and figure it out. But the moment that they have to hire a studio, then they've got to be really prepared, because otherwise they're spending much more money because it's not an internal cost. And so as a contractor, I was able to really get my clients to be much more efficient with their work. They paid much more attention to what they were doing. And you started to really see the difference in the clients, because sometimes the high-end clients or the super low-end clients would be difficult, because the high-end clients had so much money they would throw something at it and they didn't know what they want, or a really low-end client didn't have the money and they didn't have the experience to know what they want. Mm-hmm. But you have these kind of mid-range clients that are fantastic, where they're super prepared, they know how much they have enough money to do something very serious, but they're also frugal enough to make sure that they're going to come in and be very efficient. And so I kind of built my business around that. I started working with companies where we would teach them how to integrate technology to get the best creative performances and optimize their budgets, so they could actually deal with the amount of quantity and quality that we deal with in video games. The amount of work we have in games is tenfold compared to motion pictures and television.
You've mentioned technology, I think, twice now. And can you give us a little bit more insight into what do you mean when you're saying developing technology to improve the systems and to make the product better? What types of technology are you talking about?
Yeah, so for us, it's some of its production techniques, and some of it's actually physically creating technology elements for our studios. So one of the things that, like in voiceover, for example, for doing actors and video games, is the amount of content is so much more demanding than in other mediums. An average television show might have 300 or 400 lines of dialogue, like sentences of dialogue. And a motion picture might have 1,500 lines of dialogue, an entire hour and a half, 2 hour movie. But like the last Call of Duty game we did was about 41,000 lines of dialogue. And I'm doing a game this month right now that's got almost 9,000 lines of dialogue. And we did about 120,000 lines of dialogue in the last Saints Row game. So the amount of content in video games is staggering, and the quality has to be just as good or better than motion pictures and television, and the recording fidelity is much higher than what we do in television and film. So you need to create new methods and technologies to deal with that. So one of the things we did is we stopped using paper scripts the way that they're traditionally used in other areas of the entertainment industry. And we created digital scripts using Excel databases, which sounds kind of sterile and not very creative, but we came up with interesting ways to sort of keep our scripts organized way back in the 90s, just so we can deal with the amount of content that we were dealing with. And that has turned into these on-screen systems that allow the actors to read sort of like teleprompters inside the studios. But now as a director, I can control the script and highlight lines, and I can give them phonetic pronunciations, and I can create all sorts of new ways to allow the actors to be more creative as they're doing their voiceover recordings. Because if you come into a studio, it's not like you're on set. You're not in costume. You don't have other actors to work with. You're just reading off of, words off of a page. And for a person, especially an actor, to get very inspired and to understand what the other actors are saying in the scene and deliver, a very emotional performance, that takes a lot of work, and that puts a lot of burden, not just on the actor, but on the production team and the directors. So I try to use technology in a way that furthers that creative and allows the actor to feel more comfortable, not just in the studio, but also to get a little bit more context of what's going on. So some of the technologies we create do specifically that. They allow them to work with other actors. They allow them to move. They're not shackled to a microphone. Sometimes we can have it so the microphones can move with them. We created a new technology called vocap, which is a combination of motion capture and voiceover. And we have a whole stage here where we have actors that can move around. We can have six or eight actors all performing together, and they're all fully wireless. So it allows the actors to really move around and perform and lift objects and move off mic and still have a really great performance. And you start to hear it in their voices. So a lot of the video games right now are so cinematic in their nature of how they're written, and the demand on the actors is much higher than just an actor behind a microphone. You really want to hear these guys running around and sound much more like a film. So a lot of the technologies that we create are methods to allow the actors to feel more comfortable in this very technical environment of video games.
Yeah, I'm familiar with video games, just again from our connection with Jay, but for someone that might not be very familiar with the video game industry, the sheer volume of lines is due to the various scenarios that could happen depending on how many players on the screen and which options you choose. Is that correct? Is that why?
That's one element for sure. Yeah, you can actually have multiple story paths where you could go this direction or another direction, and you have to record all the different scenarios that the player or the other characters that you come across are going to say. And then each of these characters in some of these worlds might have their own entire personas where you could interact with them in a variety of different ways. You could, you could hurt them, you could befriend them, you could scare them. They could have all different types of conversations in different scenarios. So you need to record all of the different options for all the different characters. And the length of the games, especially a lot of the console and the AAA games that we work on, they have 12, 14, 15 hours of content sometimes. So it's not just a 90-minute movie, but you really have potentially, weeks and weeks of gameplay in some of these projects. So the sheer volume that goes into these games is pretty staggering.
Yeah, it's really amazing how big they've gotten as a production.
Yeah.
What do you have any tips for somebody that might be working with voice actors or bringing on talent, or maybe somebody that's got that's listening that has a podcast or an idea that they're trying to put together a team? Any tips for getting working with talent or even putting together a team for that?
Yeah, I mean, talent right now is it's an amazing time to be an actor and to work in this industry, just because there's so many new platforms that are emerging. So it's not just the video game console like a PlayStation or an Xbox anymore, but you're seeing stuff on tablets, you're seeing stuff on mobile, you're seeing VR exploding, you're seeing Steam and the rise of PC games again, which is fantastic. And so the performances all are focused around the different platforms that are coming out, and the different platforms have different demands on the actors. So, some games are animated, some have narrators, some are sports games, some are action games, and each one has different types of performers for that. And there are people and actors that specialize In all those different types of things. You have some people that are amazing narrators. You have some people that are great at doing battle chatter or soldier voices in action games. There's some people that are really good for sports games, and some people are great at animation, and a lot of foreign titles are coming into the United States, like Japanese anime and stuff out of Korea and Eastern Europe now. So for people getting in, both on the creative side, for writing, for producing, for engineering, for directing, and for acting, it's a really great time. And I think that the first thing is understanding the landscape and knowing what you like and do things that you like. Sometimes people think that they have to do everything or there's a certain type of work that they have to do. And the truth is it's what you gravitate towards is the most exciting. So if you really like Japanese anime, or you really like, you know, first person action shooters, or you really like, you know, sports games, those are the things you should focus on first, and find the projects that you relate to, and use those as a source of inspiration, and start kind of getting familiar with that, and then going into that work. There's so many great developers right now that have gone from the console space into the mobile or tablet or VR space now, that there's many, many more small teams creating games the way that games were being developed 20 years ago, where you had a handful of guys in their garage and, you know, they were doing a game independently, as opposed to these big giant teams right now of 200, 300 with multiple studios all over the world. It's really interesting to see it being very cyclical and going back to the way that games were first being created.
Yeah. Now, let's say that I was going to put together, let's say I want to do a podcast, or, you know, sort of like the old school storytelling, where I've got sound effects and I've got multiple people, and any tips, or how would you kind of go about starting to build a team and to find the right people for your team? Or what's your take on that? Or what's your recommendation for somebody that wants to put together a team to do a project?
Yeah, I mean, it's a combination on the technical side. Definitely you have to make sure that you have really good engineers. You have somebody who knows how to record, someone who knows how to edit, and someone who knows how to mix. And in the game industry, a lot of people have to wear many, many hats. And that's kind of where how I, you know, grew up learning everything, just because out of necessity. The reason I started directing was out of necessity, but I did sound and mixing and other things just because, you know, we needed to get done and we didn't have a budget to hire other people. So you just learn how to do that. Which is a little different than other industries. You know, film industry, you have a job for a very specific task, and it's nice to have someone to focus on that. But in games and where things are going right now, you really do have to learn a lot. So starting off building your team, you really need someone who has a good foundation of understanding the basics of recording, understanding how to make it sound good, how to really chop everything up and edit it and put it together, and then mix it and make sure it's all balanced and sounds commercial. So that on one side is building that team. Then on the creative side is writing is expanded into so many different types of projects and some podcasts. You know, you see things like Serial out there, another podcast where it's, you know, really exciting to hear an investigation kind of unfold through the course of that. And I think a lot of that is the writing and the structuring and the producing and the research. And there's a great opportunity for a lot of people to play a part in those types of productions. And then there's the talent. And there's actors who do performances. There's people who do narration. There's people who are hosts. And each, I think, requires their own skill set and be able to focus on that. And I think if you have a team that brings together those three elements, you've got a really strong foundation to create a strong podcast or any kind of production for that matter.
Yeah, and if somebody's not already entrenched, I mean, you've been in the industry for so long. Let's say I was interested in trying to find some voice talent. How would I go about doing that?
So there's two different worlds right now in voiceover. There's the union world and there's the non-union world, and they both have their pluses and minuses. The union world is essentially how all voice actors should be working, in the sense that the union is there to protect the actors. And it's a collective bargaining agreement, which means it's essentially a contract that all actors and all companies abide by. And for working with actors, if you're looking to hire an actor, ideally, providing your project qualifies, that you would be working with an actor that's part of the union. And to qualify for the union means that these actors have met the union criteria, and they're generally working actors. It means financially that they're paid a certain minimum, that the working conditions follow a certain standard, and there's different sort of rules depending on the industry. Video game industry has its own union contract. There's a different contract for working in commercials. There's a different one for industrials. There's another one for dubbing. So depending on the production and where you're doing, a lot of those actors work for the unions. The non-union world is sort of everyone else. And it's the actors who haven't got into the union yet. And it's a lot of actors who maybe are in different states that are right to work, or there's not enough work for the union actors there, or there's not enough industry there, but they're actors who wanted to work. You're starting to see a lot of online companies making sort of opportunities for actors. There's different online services where actors sort of kind of can bid on projects. I don't personally think that's necessarily the best thing for the industry, because it does sort of drive the value of the actors down a little bit, because they're competing for jobs and they're driving the cost down. But that's just more of a kind of a personal issue, because I really feel that the actors bring so much life to the projects.
Sure.
that having a minimum working standard for them is a good thing. The difficult part is that the unions, their contracts are sometimes up for negotiation, and sometimes the difference between what the actor union wants and what the clients need sometimes don't always line up. So sometimes the people who are breaking in the industry don't know how to navigate those waters, and that's why some projects unfortunately have to go non-union. So for producers or for people looking to hire actors, you know, everybody starts non-union somewhere. You don't just start by being a union actor. You have to cut your chops and cut your teeth on some type of project. So in the early days of video games, and the same thing for a podcast, is you hire your friend, you know, your wife, the secretary at your company,
right?
You know, your friend who's got a really great voice, and you bring him in. And almost every amazing actor I've ever worked with always started there. They've always started doing their own projects, just doing things with their friends, coming up with voices, playing around and doing things. And ultimately, those actors work so much that they move into the union and they start working on big projects. And in fact, a lot of the working actors in Los Angeles, a lot of them came out of the game industry as game testers or designers or writers or programmers. So it's interesting to see people who are working, who just out of necessity worked on their own games, and then they realized they had a profession, you know, working in games as a voice talent. So that's always a great way, is working with your friends and finding, you know, people that you get along with and start fulfilling those needs. And as your productions grow, then you start going out and doing casting, and you're starting to really look for people who do that for a living. And ultimately, you'll start to work with agencies and people who professionally cast actors to do this type of work. And it's an amazing industry. There's thousands of fantastic actors out there who specialize in doing all of this.
Yeah, and I know you know, based just on the sheer volume of projects you've worked on, you've worked with a lot of people there. Do you have any interesting stories about working with anybody particularly fascinating or anything crazy there?
I've had the honor to work on some really amazing games with, fortunately, the budgets and the ability to cast a lot of celebrity actors, and getting to work with celebrities in a motion capture or a voiceover capacity is fantastic, because it really shows you some insight into their background and their method of how they work. And it gives you an opportunity to work with people that I think, unless you were on a $150 million film or a very large caliber film, sometimes you wouldn't have the opportunity to work with some of those actors. I've got to work with everyone from Gary Oldman and Sam Worthington and Idris Elba to Hulk Hogan and Burt Reynolds and a lot of great guys. And every project is different. You know, it's you really meet them in a very personal way, and you start to learn a little bit about their life and how they do their work. And it was interesting. One project I worked on, this project I was mentioning, is worked with Burt Reynolds, and I had worked with Dom DeLuise on that same project I was working on with Tim Curry years ago. And Dom DeLuise was hilarious. He would improvise every line. He really couldn't read the script as written. But whatever he would say was 10 times funnier. And so I had all these outtakes from this recording from Dom DeLuise, and I've always kept them. Just I've never released them just because I didn't want to, you know, kind of get that out there on the internet. But they are the funniest outtakes, and he was just the most hilarious guy. And even though he couldn't get through his script, everything he did was gold. And so a few years back, I was working on Saints Row 3, I think, and we had cast Burt Reynolds as the mayor of this town. And Saints Row is a very irreverent game, and not only profanity and kind of a racy title, but also just the writing was just hilarious and a really fun game to work on. And when I had heard stories about Burt Reynolds, and I had heard that he was maybe difficult to work with or maybe just a challenge. I didn't know. I just didn't know what to expect. But I'd grown, I'd seen, you know, Smokey and the Bandit and all these other, you know,
classics,
right? And so I brought with me this recording from Dom DeLuise of all of his outtakes, and I flew out to Florida and I got in the studio, and instead of me being in the studio and him being in the voiceover booth, I set up my chair right next to him in the studio, in the voiceover booth with him, and had the engineers out in the studio. And I sat down with him, and even though we were on the clock and we had to start recording, I told him the stories of working with Dom. And at first, you know, when he first walked into the studio, you know, he's Burt Reynolds, you know, he's
right.
He's got his swagger, and he's like, "Who the hell are you?" And, you know, and I was like, "Oh boy, this is going to be a challenge," you know, working with somebody who's, you know, looking at this guy trying to direct him on a video game. And I sat down with him and I started telling him the stories of working with Dom, and I pulled out my iPad and I played him all these outtakes that no one had really ever heard before. And he started to cry. And it was just the most amazing thing, because wow. This was a friend of his that he had, you know, been so close to for so many years. And here is Dom in all of his splendor, you know, saying the most foul, funny lines that no one has ever heard. And it was amazing. And instantly he just looked at me and was like, "All right, let's go." And it was just gold. And from that moment on, like, everything he did was great. And we got along great. And the session went perfect. And he just realized, you know, it was just like, I was just, you know, connecting with him on a much different level than, "Oh, I'm just Joe Director coming in and telling him what to do." And so that was really inspirational for me, just to kind of be able to work with people, to be able to see that, like, hey, you know, we're all working guys. We all enjoy our work, but also we're friends and we're people, and we you know, you make these connections with people. So when I started working with a lot of the talent, I just want to make sure that I'm finding their personality and bringing that and their creativity into the project. Because when you're working in a very technical world like video games, it's hard to just turn on a microphone and suddenly be creative. Just to say that, you know, your friend is dying and you're going to be pouring your heart out and just start doing that on a microphone. And people are like, "Oh, they're actors. They can do that." But they really need to find those emotions from their experiences and part of their world. And to do that in a very technical environment like a video game, where you have no other actor to work with and you have no other reference and sometimes no picture and sometimes the script comes in 5 minutes before the recording session, it's hard sometimes for these actors to just suddenly turn on those emotions and nail it for, you know, hundreds if not thousands of lines of dialogue. So that was, for me, I really realized there was a great opportunity for me as a director to connect with the actors and direct them in a way that they could relate to. And that's why I started creating these technology platforms and these other different techniques to get the actors to feel more comfortable when they're doing these very emotional lines. And whether it's drama or horror or comedy, they all require, you know, different emotional ranges. And a lot of it, you know, you just need to get the actors very comfortable in this very technical space.
Have you ever had anybody or had a scenario where you've had to do something to the environment to try to help with the, you know, you mentioned, I can imagine sitting in a sterile studio, but are there any interesting tricks, or has anybody brought in any props, or have you ever done anything like that to try to help people? Or
with the system, the reason I created this vocap technology was specifically because of that. And it's interesting is that when you do traditional recording, you have a script on a piece of paper, and the actor comes in on their headphones and they're reading the script in front of them, and you're in this little bubble. You're in this like soundproof room in a big giant studio with people staring at you through the glass, and you can't hear anything unless the engineer or the director talks to you over a talkback microphone. So you're by yourself, you're very isolated, you're reading these words on the page. And sometimes you don't have any visuals to go off of, and it can be really tough on an actor, and especially for an actor who comes from working in motion pictures or television, who's used to having all those other things. So when I started to realize that a lot of the actors just didn't have that context and they needed to be able to change that, the first thing I did was I got them off of headphones. And it's amazing because when you listen to yourself through your ears versus through your head, there's a pitch difference, even though, you know, you wouldn't perceive that, you sound much deeper inside your head than you do outside to everybody else.
Yeah.
And the bones in your head conduct the sound waves differently, and you feel a little bit warmer, you sound a little bit deeper. And a lot of people say, oh, I hate the sound of what I sound like when I'm recorded. I don't want to hear myself because I hate the sound of my own voice. And the reason why is that their pitch is always a little bit higher when they hear the recording. They're like, I don't sound like that, but that's really what you do sound like. And the problem is when you're working on headphones, you're listening through your ears as opposed to through your head.
Mm-hmm.
And you're constantly correcting yourself and you're changing the way you perform. And actors who are really good at it, especially narrators or animated actors, they're really good at using their ear to dial in that perfect sound. But the truth is that you stumble, you stutter, you slur words, there's a lot of just imperfections in the way that voice is delivered. But in a voiceover studio, there's this pressure to do everything perfectly, to have every voice delivered at the right volume with no popping of your P's, no mouth noise. Everything's got to be exactly perfectly articulated. And that's not the real world. It doesn't sound real. And the problem is when a lot of these actors are working on headphones in a sterile environment, like a studio like that, it sounds too perfect. And a lot of times you listen to video games and I just listen to it and it just doesn't sound real. It sounds very canned.
Yeah.
And so one of the first things I did is I got these actors off of their headphones and we created a talkback system so the actors could perform and move around the microphone without being shackled to these headphones. And instantly that changed. A brief story is I had this guy, he was the middleweight boxing champion in England. And I'd seen him in a couple movies. He had been in Ali and a couple other films, a guy named Michael Bent, amazing actor. And I was working on The Shield. It was a video game based on the television show.
Okay.
And we had this, and we had Michael Chiklis and we had all these other guys involved in the show, in the game. But there was a part where there was like a kind of a gang boss or a drug leader. And I cast Michael as this gang leader because I'd seen him in these films and I knew he could play this really intimidating gang guy. And so, but he had never done a voiceover before. He'd been on camera plenty of times, but he had never been in a studio before. And he came in and he's a big guy. I mean, he's a big buff dude. And anyway, he's just intimidating because of his size. And he comes in, I'm like, okay, so this guy's gonna be yelling out orders, he's gonna be giving, yelling out commands, and you're gonna go into battle and you ultimately have to fight this guy. And so put him in the booth, set him up with his script, put on his headphones, and we start his recording, and he starts whispering all of his lines. And I'm like, dude, what are you doing? And I'm like, hey, you're yelling at your guys are like 30 feet away from you. You're yelling in the middle of a gunfight. I need you to scream at these guys. And he's like, all right, I need you guys to go and do this. And he starts whispering again. And I'm like, whoa, what's going on? And I talked to him and like he understood, but it just for whatever reason he thought he was loud. And I went in and I realized that his headphones were kind of loud, and in his head his voice was super loud. So I said, hey, wait a second. And I turned off his headphones. I took off his headphones and I flipped him over to talkback. And I said, you know what? Do those lines again. And suddenly he just starts screaming and it's like almost blew out the mic. And you realize that's the problem is that to the actors, if they're listening, especially if they don't have the experience to work on that and they're hearing themselves through their headphones, it is a totally different world. So by getting these actors more comfortable in a way that they're used to performing, whether it be on camera or otherwise, it completely changed the feeling of their performance and in this case, the volume. So that was the first stage in understanding what the actor needs. The second thing was their scripts. You know, reading off a paper script is sometimes challenging because they don't know where you're at. They don't know what the emphasis is. They're just reading words on a page, and they can improvise and come up with this idea. But it's really the director to inform them about the emotional attitude and what's going on. And in video games, we're dealing with thousands and thousands and thousands of lines. So in these early days of video games, we're printing out reams and reams of paper just to get through these scripts. And so that's when I realized that we needed to come up with something much more efficient that was more intuitive for the actors to read. And I could sort of control the pacing of it and the presentation of it. So we created these on-screen systems. And what that did is it got the actors out of like this little bubble of holding their script and kind of curled up reading the paper. And now they're straightening their posture. They're looking up at these screens. They're not shackled to their headphones, and their performances instantly sound much more realistic. So on games like Ghost Recon or on Call of Duty, you'll notice a lot of people are saying, how do you get these actors to get, you know, these really realistic performances? And the real reason is we got them out of that actor bubble. We got them off their headphones. We got them off their paper scripts, and we got them moving. We started to get them to move around the microphone to really start to add action. And then taking that a step further, we started to give them props. We started giving them actual, you know, prop guns and allowing them to move around the room. And we created these headsets where the actors can actually wear these custom headsets that that we designed. And now they can move around and start to add the physicality to the performance. So if someone's lifting something, they can really lift something in the studio, and you hear that in their voice as opposed to just acting on microphone. So all these little techniques are ways that really encourage the actors to be much more natural and bring out their acting abilities, because they're not voice actors, they're actors. And they're using their voice to add in all of those efforts and the breathing and all the emotion to the lines through their voice, when you don't have the benefit of seeing their body or any of the physicality that's there. But your ear can really hear it.
Yeah, that's really great advice. I think the takeaway there is that regardless of what project you're working on, it's, you know, we tend to get so stuck in doing what everybody else has done or what we've been doing, but that's a really great a testament to trying something new and to kind of figuring out how to make it, realizing it's not working and then experimenting to try to figure out how to make it work better. That's great.
And there really is no one way to do anything. I mean, we've created our own techniques that work for us, and we've found ways to sort of make that more efficient and better for the actors and more creative. But you know, every actor comes from a different background, and every performer has their own sort of skill set and things that they like to do and their experiences. So the idea is to work around the talent, find what inspires the actor or the performance, and get what's best for them without messing up the rest of the pipeline and your budget and your technology. You still need to work within the confines of the technology, but do what's best for the actor to get the performance you need without making them feel like they're inside of a box. And when you do that, when you free them out of that box, you get magic. And that's what it's great to see that with actors. And I've come on so many projects where I've had to pick up a project where, I've replaced the director, or I've come onto a project and they just didn't understand why they couldn't get the performances out of the actor. And it wasn't the actor's fault. It's just the actors wasn't armed with the right materials to really do what they were best at. And it's really neat to see those actors take off, especially when it's a celebrity, when it's an actor who hates the voiceover process, who hates ADR, who hates video games and studios, and they think it's terrible. And all of a sudden they get really inspired, and it turns them around, and they love the process because they found a whole new opportunity for themselves to work.
Has any other studios or production houses that kind of do what you do, have they picked up any of your technology, or is that sort of proprietary? You try to keep it close to the vest there.
For me, I could definitely patent a lot of the technologies that we've created, but I don't want to really go after other studios or be in a situation where I'm suing my competition. I'm not that kind of guy. And certainly you've seen our script systems in Excel and our on-screen systems become pretty standard in the industry right now. And all the studios in Los Angeles have kind of adapted the on-screen
That's great.
Sort of methodology. What we're doing with vocap is sort of an extension of what I do for mocap anyway. But it's a little expensive because we generated these headsets. I worked with Jim Cameron's guys to develop these headsets, actually. Some of the guys who were working on Avatar with my friend Sam Worthington.
Nice.
And we created these custom headsets that would really free up the actors and feel very comfortable and allow them to be wireless. And but creating those and the kind of microphones and the kind of way to power those microphones is a little difficult and expensive. And then you need a space that's soundproof, that's got engineers and room for the actors to move around. And then it's also set up for game work. So it's not the kind of thing that a lot of studios can easily do. So people have been experimenting with it, and we're trying to, you know, help grow the industry for sure. But I think we're the only people that have really done this successfully so far.
That's really cool. Let's shift a little bit more towards your current projects. Now, I know we talked a little bit before we officially recorded about you've got several things going on of your own projects. And so you've kind of made a transition. It sounds like you're doing both. You're still doing some of that type of production work, or as your firm is doing it, contracted with other companies. But tell us a little bit about some of the projects that you've done on your own that you've kind of ventured out into.
Yeah, I mean, I've had the benefit of working with these amazing clients in these projects for the past 20 years, and these big franchises with just amazing licenses, and everything from Spider-Man and Transformers through, you know, all these other types of big film and television properties, but all these other amazing teams that have created their own original projects, you know, from the Call of Duty teams to the Ghost Recon guys. All those kind of guys are fantastic, but the thing that's amazing is you're in a very creative space working with amazing people developing not only technology but just writing and producing. And so I had come from a very creative background and loved working on these projects, but I had a lot of original ideas that I wanted to develop as well. So over the past 10 years, I started to write my own stories and produce projects. And that started through graphic novels. And I created, my first book was a book called Ascend. And Ascend became the top-selling book for Image Comics and number 17, I think, in the country when it was released. And it sold out like nationwide. We did this big run with Image and sold out nationwide in about 5 days.
That's great.
It's a big 5-day run. And so I realized that, oh, this is actually kind of fun. So I started to create more of these. So I've created three other graphic novels, a book called Infex, another one called Dead Speed, and then I have one called Frost Road that's just coming out. And all of those are now being optioned into motion pictures and games and for television. And so that started to really put me down this path of creating my own content. And by pre-visualizing the stories as a comic book or a graphic novel was great because you could sort of flesh out the story, the characters, the environment, the world, the look, the tone of the project. And then that started to evolve into learning about not only writing and creating, but then and producing your own projects. But then it got into the manufacturing and distribution and marketing of your own projects. So when I was working on my next book, Infex, I wanted to have the book to be something that was a bit of a collector's item. So the story itself was a graphic novel, but I wanted to have packaging in a way that the audience could integrate into the property and be part of the story. And so I started to use a lot of viral and social marketing to develop the characters online. So as I was writing the book, I created Twitter accounts for the main characters and developed websites for some of the locations and the people inside the book, and delivered a lot of the fiction of the story online as real characters that could interact with the audience.
That's cool.
And that was really cool because we started to generate hundreds of thousands and ultimately millions of followers that were interacting with our characters. And it wasn't a movie or a television show or a video game. It was just these characters from an upcoming graphic novel, but they didn't know what it was. They just knew that it was a fascinating story, and they started to get involved with these characters, and it started to turn into what was better known as like an ARG, like an alternate reality game. So I had these characters that started giving clues and locations, and people would go and find these clues or go to these locations, and they would actually get these encrypted files or other things that would lead them to other parts of this puzzle. And then they would get on these online forums and collaborate with hundreds of thousands of other people to start to decipher these codes. And when they would figure these things out, it would take them to the next part of the puzzle and ultimately the next part of the story. So it was sort of real-time storytelling. And it was just taking the world and the characters from my graphic novels and developing them into an interactive experience for the audience that was evolving in real time. And as the audience was finding these things, I could see what they were liking and disliking, and I could change the story and modify the characters and interact with them using fiction of my characters, but in a real world setting. So that was a lot of fun, because now I'm literally using the power of the internet to tell a new type of story. And but all the meanwhile, it's all pointing back to this graphic novel that's going to be coming out. So I was manufacturing this book to be sort of like a coffee table book. It was going to have a metal cover around it, and had this great printer that I had worked with in the past doing my stuff for Ascend. And no one in the United States would print these things because the metal was too expensive and too difficult to machine, and we couldn't find anything up in Canada. So ultimately, we found this manufacturer in Asia that would help design and manufacture these things, but they had to be shipped in from China and Korea. And when they got to customs held them for like a month. They thought that these were like laptops or some kind of, they scanned these boxes of books, and they're all metal. And meanwhile, we're doing this viral campaign for our book, and everything's going to be leading up to launching this book at Comic-Con. And so our printer is, you know, saying, hey, look, I promise we're going to get these books to you by Comic-Con. They're being held up in customs right now, but I assure you we're going to get them to you. So we launched this huge campaign. We've got hundreds of thousands, now almost millions of fans that have been following this graphic novel and the story online. And we get to Comic-Con. We've got a huge booth. We've got all the advertising set up. All the fans are coming to buy this book that's coming out to launch at Comic-Con. And the printer shows up the day before the show, and he shows up in tears. And he's a great guy. And I was like, what's going on? What's wrong? And he opens up the first box of books, and apparently customs, and you know, not no way to prove it, but customs was so frustrated and furious that these books had come in, and they thought they were sort of mislabeled as electronics or something else like that because of the metal covers. And every single one of our pallets that was held in the warehouse in customs was knocked down. So when he opens up this book, this box of books at Comic-Con, they're all dented. These brand new books that we're about to sell, completely dented. And we could only sell like one out of every 10 of these books. And I'm like, you know, I don't want to deal with this. I'm not a book distributor. I'm not a book publisher. I don't want to deal with customs and warehousing and taxes and shipping and fulfillment. I just want to write a book and get it out to the audience. And so what was really interesting is that at around that time, the iPad is exploding and we're creating all of our assets digitally. And here I am with recording studios with great actors and sound design and music. And we have editorial staff and animation. And I've got this graphic novel that really needs to be delivered in a new way. And so what I did is I ended up bringing together a small team, and using some of our game development background, we created this app that became one of the first interactive graphic novels. And it's called Infex, and it's on the iPad. And I brought in actors to do all the voices, and not really a book on tape, but to actually act through all of the dialogue, all of the scenes, almost like a radio drama. But every single panel of the graphic novel now had animation and sound effects and music and a background, and then all these amazing actors. And so I brought in all the guys from the top video games, and I brought a lot of my celebrity friends in, like Lance Henriksen and Michael Wincott and William Fichtner and Roger Cross and Glenn Morshower and all these guys that are fantastic, you know, film and television actors. And they acted out all of the scenes using our vocap systems here at PCV. And we put together this kind of unique graphic novel where you're reading the book, but you're listening to a movie. And it's a great hybrid because as you're reading the pages, you're hearing how I intended it to be performed as a film. And that was a great inspiration to be able to see that now not only could we take what has traditionally been in a paperback form for, you know, 80 years, 100 years, but now it's being distributed in a digital form with all these extra sort of elements. And I'm not distributing it through traditional bookstores, which are struggling to stay alive. And I love books, and I love having a coffee table book and something physical that I can, you know, lift and hold and have a tangible thing.
Yeah.
But here I'm creating everything digitally, and now I can distribute it digitally. And using Apple's iTunes, you know, the App Store as a delivery method, I have a whole new way of distributing this book that I can profit higher from because there's no middleman distributor in that. And I'm keeping the quality high, and I can interact with my audience through all my social platforms and integrate that into the app. So Twitter and Facebook and email and all the web browsing is all built into the app. So the cool thing about that is that now that allows the audience to not just read the book and hear it the way I intended it to be, but also interact back with the characters and with me. And I can slowly evolve the story by people interacting with the app. So that to me has now established this whole new platform of creating content, because it's not a video game and it's not a television show or a film, but I can integrate all of the benefits of that in a new way of distributing content and a new way for the audience to experience something that they're not just reading on paper now.
And for those listening, that's available in the iTunes store, correct? It's INFEX. Is that correct?
Yeah, correct. Absolutely. And right now that's just on the iPad. But we're creating a new version for the Apple TV, and we'll do stuff for the iPhone. And I'm now using that technology and that basis of that design to launch my next motion picture. And we're going to be doing television shows that way. And my next graphic novel will also use that same idea. So for me, it's a new platform. It's not just a new technology or something that we created just out of necessity for getting this book out. But now this is something that I could see this for education. I could see this for, you know, musicians delivering albums. It's a cool second screen experience for television. I'm delivering this new film that I'm working on right now in this capacity. And definitely for graphic novels, it's a great way to experience a book.
I want to ask, where do you think you've been in the industry for a while now, and you've kind of got your finger on the pulse. Where do you think things are going with all the shakeup in the audio industry and the book industry? And you mentioned about gaming moving back into small teams, and there's just so much stirring and so much, you know, to use a tech phrase, disruption. From your perspective, where do you think we're headed with all that?
Well, it's interesting. Is it technology? It's a double-edged sword for what it's done, and it started in the book industry. You started to see that, like desktop publishing, where it used to be so difficult to publish something, now through computers and desktop publishing, you were able to put out your own books and ebooks. And what I even did with this graphic novel was a whole new way to change that. And then you started to see the technology in music change, right? Where musicians could record stuff at home. And it started in the rap industry, where rap artists were creating their own home studios and doing these albums that way. And then other musicians started to do things at home. And what that did was that provided a much more open environment for creative people to do something that used to be cost prohibitive. It used to be that you, like when I got in, you would have to go to a multi-million-dollar recording studio to do your demo to get a record deal. But suddenly the technology got powerful enough and the quality got high enough that you could record at home and you could do these demos at home. And so it was much more opportunity for everyone, but that also meant that there was much more competition. So what it did in the past was it sort of weeded out a lot of people who unfortunately may not have had the financial means, but if you were really good, you know, as the method was that if your quality was high enough that you would get those deals. But the truth is that there was incredibly talented people out there that just didn't have the financial resources to be heard or seen. And as soon as the technology opened that up, now everyone could get out there. And the internet at the same time provided a distribution method for doing that. And So then that started to move its way into filmmaking, right? So now you had these much less expensive cameras, so independent films could be made much cheaper. And you had this flood of filmmakers that came into the film industry. And what that did was that that disrupted that industry drastically, because now it wasn't like you would have to just pitch a story to a financier and get a movie made. Now you would actually shoot a film just to get it sold. And that really, you started to see that the book industry has been broken for the past several years. The music industry has been broken as a result of that. The film industry now is very broken as a result of that. And that's why it's a double-edged sword, because it's offered so much more opportunity for people to create, but it's put all the power into the distributors because it's a buyer's market. There's such a flood of creative people out there who just want to work that they're willing to do it for nothing. And like I was saying earlier about the actors, there's so many actors out there who would be willing to take less money than what the unions would provide, that unfortunately that sort of undervalued the profession. And that's definitely what happened in music, and it definitely happened to writing and filmmaking. And in games, that's also what sort of happened, right? Was that you had all these larger console games, which were very expensive to produce. And when guys left doing these big games, they started their own teams and they started smaller upstarts, but they couldn't afford to work on a giant console game. So they started to work in the only medium that they could really afford to, which was mobile or tablets or online games. And so that has created this flood of independent games, which is great because there's a lot of amazingly talented people creating independent games, but there's also a tremendous amount of competition because everyone can do it who has that skill set. So that's sort of what's happening right now, is that you're seeing all these industries go through this massive transformation because the technology is opening it so they can do the work, and the internet is providing a distribution means for them to get it out to the audience. And it's created what a lot of people refer to as just a lot of noise, not in a bad way, but there's so many people doing such great work that it's this high level of noise because there's so many people all doing great work that no one's able to be successful at it. And, you know, there's always the saying that the cream rises to the top, and that's true. But what's happening right now is you're seeing an explosion in social marketing and viral marketing. And with all the social media platforms for Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and all the other different platforms that are out there, now you're starting to see the media or these different industries rely on social media to get above the noise. You're seeing actors that are getting cast because they have a million Twitter followers, or they have a giant Instagram following, or they've got millions of people on Vine or a YouTube channel that's very successful.
Yeah, they're going to bring their audience with them.
And that's the goal. Right? That's what these distributors are counting on. They're saying, well, if we cast this actor or bring on this musician and they've already generated, you know, 20 million views for their music video, then we're going to sign this artist because he's already built his audience. Whereas in the old days, an A&R guy would have to go to a club to see a band perform. And if they could bring in an audience and play in front of a crowd, then they would discover an audience, you know, that band, and bring them out. Nowadays, if you build your own social following, you now are very valuable because you're bringing your audience with you. And that's what's changing right now, is that the marketing and the social and the viral element of the creativity is as important as the creative itself, because there's such great abundance of creative, great work out there that you need something else beyond that. And that's really the next wave of what's happening. So in technology, as virtual reality comes in, as mobile and tablet gaming explodes, as all these different industries kind of converge and people are using the internet to be able to use this as a new means of distributing their content, then that allows them to get out to a much larger audience, but they need to stand out. And that's why they're leaning so heavily on their social platforms.
Well, that's a perfect segue to my next question. What if I came to you, whether I was going to do a new podcast or a graphic novel or even a low budget film, what should I do to stand out? You know, what is your recommendation for what can people do to break through that noise?
Well, that's really what I'm exploring right now. And I just did my first motion picture this year called The Phoenix Incident. And I started about 2-3 years ago, before the film was obviously out, while it was still in production, and I started to build the viral campaign for that film to do what I did on Infex, to really build out the characters, to build out the world, and to start to get the audience familiar with the world that I was going to do. Because for a film, the film was only just over $1 million. It was about $1.3 million for shooting the film. And compared to, you know, a Star Wars or Independence Day or some of these giant sure. blockbusters, you know, you're still, you know, you're competing for the same eyeballs, but they're spending $150 million and you're spending $1.3, you know, something's going to change. And, but as a filmmaker, you know, I still wanted to be able to take advantage of the technology that I've got here, my creative background, the actors I've worked with, the studio facilities we have, and bring all that production value to what we're doing. But I needed a way to get above that noise, right? And to compete with other studios. And not that I'm trying to take on Independence Day in any way, shape, or form, but there's thousands of independent films out there that are fantastic that just end up on Netflix, that don't get any theatrical support, that don't get any distribution, that are lucky to even get into a film festival. So what I started to do is to realize that I needed to build an audience before the film was going to come out. And so what I did was I took the subject matter of the film, which was all based on real events, and it was based on the largest mass UFO sighting in U.S. history.
Right.
And this big UFO cover-up with the military that people kind of blame. There's conspiracy theories that the military was actually covering up this UFO sighting. And I wove our fiction of our story through all of these events. And by doing that, it's already a viral event. It's already a UFO sighting. It's already a military conspiracy. It's already, you know, got a lot of controversy behind it. So to weave our characters through that, the audience is aware of some of the background and the history of that, but now I'm integrating our characters into that, and that makes it much more compelling. Because now that's not meant to be a disinformation campaign, but it is meant to sort of build up the fiction of the world. And years ago, you saw like Cloverfield or the Blair Witch Project or these other projects where they would build out the fiction outside of the film, and I was really inspired by that because here people are saying, well, wait a second, that's real. I heard about that. That really did happen in Phoenix. And there were 30,000 people that witnessed this. And the governor did come out on CNN and said he saw a spaceship. And, you know, what was the controversy? And were there flares? And did people go missing? And all these different questions. And so I started shooting additional footage for the movie, specifically for this viral campaign. And I created backstories for all of our characters. I created conspiracy theories around the military cover-up. I shot additional footage for the UFO cover-up. And I started to leak this online through some of our characters. We had investigative journalists. We created about two dozen websites that are out there that are still up right now. And they're very real. That's the thing, that there were cult websites and missing person sites and news sites and all these different sites that you could get this information that had no bearing on the marketing of the film. There was no advertising for the name of the film. This was just building the fiction out and not meaning to hoax the audience, but to get them sort of intrigued into this conspiracy theory. So one of the things that we did was that we had a character who's an investigative journalist who comes out of Phoenix. And he started to report about this cover-up, about these missing guys who went missing the night of this mass UFO sighting. And he, last year, he released this 14-second clip of this military footage that he had acquired that showed these jets, these F-16 jets engaged with these unknown craft flying over the Estrella mountain range in Phoenix, Arizona back in 1997. And he launched this little 14-second clip that came right out of the film. And this thing went incredibly viral. It got 2 million views within the first 2 to 3 days. It was on the front cover of the Mirror UK as this authentic UFO sighting. And we weren't trying to hoax people. This was just basically building up the fiction of our world. But suddenly we had millions and millions of views of some of our story that was going to be coming out into this film the next year. So that was some of the building blocks of what we were trying to do to try to get the audience really fascinated and start talking about our movie. And that's how you get above the noise, is you get people starting to talk about it. Now, that's controversial because, you know, some people don't want to be, you know, feel like they're being hoaxed. Some people don't want to feel like that's disinformation. But when we're talking about UFOs and military conspiracy theories, you know, our society right now doesn't always necessarily trust the government or what we're being told. And there's, you know, Area 51 and Roswell and all these other different sort of long-term conspiracy theories that we don't know if aliens have been here and other things. So to say that this isn't real is like pot calling the kettle black. You know, you can't really criticize that, because who's to say what's real and what's not?
Well, that's really fascinating, Keith. Out in my world of digital marketing, and I have a lot of interaction with a lot of people that are starting online businesses, and the current philosophy now is to go find out where an audience exists and what they want, and then go produce something for them. So instead of, you know, going into the hole and producing a widget or an app or a information product and then bringing it out to the world and say, look what I made for you, and trying to find people to buy it, actually going to an audience of people that are already interested in right. your topic, in your whatever your area of expertise is, or your widget that you want to build, and say, what's wrong with the current widgets? You know, what do you want? Okay, I'm going to go make that for you. And then you bring it back to them. I love how you've kind of done that with the entertainment sector. That's really great.
Well, you definitely have to be very respectful of that audience, because, you know, I identified three pillars for this. There was the UFO audience. There was obviously the found footage, thriller, horror genre kind of audience that loves these kind of movies. And then also, I come from the gaming world, and all of my cast were all the top video game actors. So I had Yuri Lowenthal and Troy Baker and Liam O'Brien and Travis Willingham and Brian Bloom and all these top video game actors that I've worked with on all my video games for the past 10, 15 years. And I needed this cast of very good, very believable actors that weren't celebrities, which is tough, because in films, everyone wants to say, who's the star? Who's your cast? And here I've got great actors, but they're not known in the film industry. And you also have to be very respectful of those audiences, because, you know, I didn't want the UFO audience to think I'm hoaxing them, because I believe that there's got to be life in outer space, you know, and I love conspiracy theories, and I love, you know, trying to get the truth behind something. And I didn't want the UFO audience to think that I'm just trying to hoax that audience. I really want this film to sort of evoke a response in the audience to, I want the audience to really research and investigate for themselves, and to really pressure the government to say, hey, if you don't have anything to hide, then just release your UFO files. And I think there was even a news report yesterday that's talking about that Obama is talking about, you know, before he leaves office, is to release all of the country's UFO files. And Hillary Clinton's campaign said that she gets into the office, that she's going to release these UFO, you know, files. And so there's a lot of cultural focus right now on getting the truth behind this subject. So it's a very relevant subject. Mm-hmm. And to have a conspiracy theory in the middle of this, you're weaving your fiction and the reality of what's going on in the world into the same project. And by using these websites and your viral marketing campaign, you can pivot every single day and communicate with your audience using relevant topics as they come out in the news to further your narrative. And then ultimately it's going to come out in a film or a television show or a book or whatever your product's going to be. But that's the way to kind of rise above the noise, is because you're identifying your audience and then you're delivering content specifically to that audience, as opposed to this shotgun approach of just hitting everybody and hoping that one out of 100 is going to like what you do.
That's awesome. I mean, I think that's a really gold nugget there to take away.
It's not necessarily a mainstream, you know, approach, but that's how you break in, right? And then ultimately you make that so it becomes a more mainstream product. But I think that's where you're going to see creators working these days now, is that they're going to find their audience just the way that a YouTube star or a Twitter, you know, audience is going to follow someone. Now you're going to find a filmmaker, a musician, someone who's going to create to their audience, and they're going to use the power of the internet and the technology that they're working on to distribute content back to that audience. So instead of getting hired on a big motion picture because you have a big following, you're just going to deliver content straight to your audience. And that's what you're seeing musicians doing. You're seeing authors doing that right now. And you're going to see that with filmmakers and video game makers.
That's great. Well, I've only got one more question for you, and then if it's too long to answer, then just say we'll have to save that one for another time. But I asked Jay if there was anything I should ask you, and he said ask him about the sushi dinner with the guys from Dolby.
Oh,
is that a long story, or is that something that you can? He said it wouldn't really relate to anything, but it's a good story.
not really related to anything we've been talking about, but it is a good story. So I have a great relationship with the guys. I hope I don't get them too much in trouble, but I have a really great relationship with the guys from Dolby. And I've been working with them for about 20 years. And, you know, Dolby Surround, Dolby Digital, and all the different technologies they've done, I've had a great relationship with them, and working in the game space and now films. And one of the main guys that sort of worked with me as a representative, but as a good friend, and we had worked together. Dolby occasionally will, well, not occasionally, they go to all the big audio engineering conferences and other events to sort of get creators involved with their technology, because the more people who are creating using Dolby products is great for them, because then there's more content for people to then buy a Dolby television or Dolby stereos, you know, that type of thing. So I've had a great relationship just creating stuff using Dolby, and they were in town for the audio engineering convention years ago. This is about maybe 10-15 years ago. And this guy took me and a handful of creators out. There was one of the guys was on tour with George Clinton, and some of the guys from a couple other production houses, maybe like five or six of us. And they took us to one of the nicest sushi restaurants here in Los Angeles. And we had this great dinner. My wife was out of town. And so I had all night. I was like, I could stay out all night and didn't have to worry about, you know, bothering her, waking her up. So we went out to the sushi restaurant and we're having this great time. And the guys, you know, from George Clinton's tour is great. And the guys from Dolby are really funny. And we're just ordering, you know, beers and ordering sushi. And they start passing around the menus. And everyone starts, you know, gets their own sushi menu. And what no one realized was that we were not only ordering what we wanted, but we were ordering for the table. So we're like, oh, we'll get some of this. We'll get some of this. And everyone sort of ordered for everybody else. And no one sort of cross-checked their, you know, their sushi menus. So we handed it back to the guy, and we're hanging out and drinking. And there's like George Clooney went walking by, and there's all these celebrities there. And we're just kind of like, you know, just enjoying the atmosphere and how cool this sushi restaurant is. And about, I don't know, about 30 minutes later, this guy comes out with this massive tray. I mean, we're talking like 50, 60 pieces of sushi on this enormous tray. It's like a 2-foot by 2-foot tray, maybe even more. And it was just huge, packed with, and this is not a cheap restaurant, right? Yeah. And this just is enormous platter of sushi. And all of us at the table look at this thing and we're like, how in the hell are we going to eat that much sushi? I mean, it was just so much sushi. And behind them was three more of these platters.
Oh my gosh.
And they like literally they brought these platters and just put it onto the table. And it didn't even fit on this table with like the six of us sitting there. There was just no way we were going to be able to ever eat even like one of these platters, much less like four of these things. And so we felt kind of guilty because this is like some of the most amazing sushi in Los Angeles. And here we are, like, it's just unbelievable amount of food. So we're eating and eating and feeling more guilty about eating it than enjoying it because it's just too much food. And I think we may have cleared one of the platters. And at the end, we're bursting and we're just like, what do we do? And we can't like throw it away. We couldn't send it back. And I'm sure the sushi chef saw the menus and just started adding more sushi as they're like, oh, they're never going to know. So we had like so much sushi that we didn't know what to do with. So this guy who is touring with George Clinton says, well, hey, you know, George is in town right now. He's recording at Miles Davis Jr.'s house. Why don't we go over there and see if they want it? So we're like, okay, that sounds cool. So we pack up all of this sushi, and it turns out to be like, I don't know, it's like $4,000 or $6,000 worth of sushi. I mean, it was, these poor guys from Dolby had to turn in this expense report of just like thousands of dollars of sushi, which is just horrible. So we drive across Los Angeles and we drive to Miles Davis Jr.'s house, and they let us in the gates, and we go up this great driveway, and at the pool house, there's all this music coming out of this pool house. And we walk over there and open the door, and this, you know, smoke comes like bellowing out of this place. And his whole band, George Clinton, his whole band, they're just in this really cool guest house at Miles Davis Jr.'s house, and they're just playing, they're just jamming, recording there. And it was like that scene in Animal House with this group of like these like nerdy white guys kind of walk into this room with these big African American guys, all cool guys, all playing, and they just kind of stopped and looked at us, and we're like, "We brought sushi," and we walked in, and we spent the entire night just hanging out with these guys, and they're playing music, and we brought all this amazing sushi, and they're there, and I just remember this like sitting there, and George is there, and he's just like just baked out of his mind, and it was just so funny. It was just so funny. He's just like hanging out there. He's wearing his sunglasses. It's totally mellow, and one hand he's got his hand in this bag of Cool Ranch Doritos, and the other hand he's got like four pieces of sushi, and he's shoving it into his mouth. And I can't, unfortunately, I think on the podcast, I think it would be a little too inappropriate to say what he told me. But needless to say, it was the most hilarious kind of experience, just hanging out there and having this night of hanging out with the guys from Dolby, hanging out with George Clinton, seeing George Clooney, being at Miles Davis Jr. house. And I come back and that night, it's like 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning. And I'm just amped up, and I'm just so excited from all the experience for the night. And my wife calls me in the morning, and I'm just like, and I start telling her this experience, and she's just grinning, and she's like, "You had a really good night, didn't you?" And I was like, yeah, that's one for the books. So needless to say, that was our sushi night with George Clinton and Dolby.
That's funny. I ran into George Clinton. I went to UNC Chapel Hill, and there I worked my senior year at a 4-star hotel. That was the only 4-star hotel in that area.
Yeah.
And there was this place called the Cat's Cradle, which was bands from, you know, Pearl Jam, Dave Matthews Band. I mean, everybody's been there. Wow. And George Clinton was playing there, and he stayed at the hotel. And George Clinton checked him into his room, and I think he tipped me with a 20 or something. But some of the other bellhops, he would tip people with coloring pages out of a coloring book that he had colored.
Oh, wow. So,
he was like, "Hey, man, here's your tip." And he would give him a piece of a paper out of a coloring book that he had colored.
Wow. Yeah. What a cool cat.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, you know, working in the music industry, I was, you know, unfazed by that because I was on Capitol and we toured with all these other bands and always been around musicians. So being really comfortable, you know, working in that space. But it's just kind of cool to be a fan too, you know, to have that experience of just someone that you respect and get to see them working and just to be completely out of your element and just seeing them in theirs. And I really appreciated that because I kind of felt that by working at such a young age and, you know, professionally touring at 14 and doing all these things that I really never had that experience of sort of appreciating from the audience perspective, because I was always on the other side of it. And that was one of those nights where I just kind of got to fanboy out and kind of geek out and just enjoy the night and just hang out with all these great guys, you know, just being that fan. So that story always has a place in my heart just because I had a really unique experience.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. And, we've gone really long, so I'm going to wrap up here. I really appreciate it, man. It's been a good time. I could listen to your stories. I would love to talk to you longer. But where can we go, for people that want to learn more about you, connect with you, I think you mentioned you're on Twitter. Where would you like to send people?
Sure. So for me personally, I'm at Keith Arum on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. My company is PCB Productions, and that's at PCB Productions, both on Twitter and Instagram and also on Facebook. And then there's also ones for all my projects. So you can go to at Phoenix Incident on Twitter, on Facebook, it's Phoenix Incident. The motion picture official site is phoenixincident.com. That book Infex I told you about, there's infex.tv, which is the website, and you can find it on the iPad store for the App Store for iTunes for Infex, Infex. And then there's a lot of links to some of our viral marketing things. So for Phoenix Incident, some of the viral marketing I was telling you about, so those hidden sites, there's one called MaricopaMissing.com. There was KWBV News was one of the hidden sites.
Okay.
There's another one called AmericanCrimes.tv. So those are all kind of fun little inroads to see some of the viral marketing things that we've done and continue to do some. And we're sowing the seeds for some of the next movies and television shows I'm working on. So I'll send you some links to share with the audience in a little bit, and you can start to see some of the early stages of some of the next things that'll come out next year.
Yeah, please do. I put together a list of all the links mentioned in my show notes page.
Great.
And it'll be just supersimple.com/Keith. And I'll mention that at the end again. But yeah, I'll have all those links. And if you want to send me something when you get, you know, other projects going, I'll be happy to update that, because, you know, as podcasts, they'll stay out there. It's evergreen. People will be picking this up in months to come. So
absolutely. And you're always welcome to go to my own website, which is just pcbproductions.com, and get a good kind of sense of some of the other projects we're developing as well. So,
well, that's great. Keith, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And let's keep in touch. Thanks a lot.
Hey, David. Thanks. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Thanks.
Bye. Thanks for listening to this episode of Remarkable, part of the Super Simple Podcast Network. I appreciate you taking time to join me today, and I hope you got a lot out of my interview with Keith. You can find my notes from this interview, all the relevant links mentioned, and a full transcript at supersimple.com/Keith. That's supersimple.com/KEITH. If you enjoyed this episode or learned something to help you with your podcast or business, please do me a huge favor and share it with someone else. Also, just like on Amazon, user reviews let people know if the show is worth listening to or not. So if you don't mind, please take a minute to head over to iTunes and leave me an honest review. I would greatly appreciate it. And last but not least, if you have a question about marketing, a suggestion or feedback for me, or if you just want to connect, please take a minute to email me. My email address is dave@supersimple.com. This episode of Remarkable is sponsored by Bethesda Roasting Company, a North Carolina-based small-batch gourmet coffee roaster that prides itself on offering only the highest quality single-origin coffee from around the world, perfectly roasted to present the best flavors of each varietal they sell. In addition to using only quality beans, all coffees are roasted within 72 hours of being shipped. And as a self-proclaimed coffee snob myself with over 9 different ways to make coffee at home, I can tell you from experience that if you've never had coffee that's been roasted within just a few days before you brew it, you don't know what you're missing. Fresh coffee is night and day from anything that you can even purchase in a grocery store or a boutique store or even something like a Whole Foods. So head on over to BethesdaCoffee.com. Check out their monthly subscription plan so you can get it fresh to your door. Use code SUPERSIMPLE50 at checkout to save 50% on your first purchase of their Explorer or Adventurer subscription. That's BethesdaCoffee.com, and I promise you, you will not be disappointed. Our theme music was composed by Julio Gonzalez at Zymer. Zymer, or Remix, spelled backwards, offers sound design and audio post-production for podcasts, video, audiobooks, game, apps, and radio. In addition to my theme music, I've also been using Zymer for some of my post-production work, and I've been extremely pleased with the result. You can learn more about them or contact them today at zymer.co, that's ximer.co, and tell Julio you heard about Zymer on the Remarkable podcast. You can save 50% on any of their services. And if you would like additional marketing resources, early access to my free podcast marketing course designed to help you grow your audience and reach more listeners, and to be notified when I release future episodes, head on over to theremarkablepodcast.com. That's it. Thanks again for listening to this episode of Remarkable.